Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The studies show that kids who grow up without fathers are more likely to have behavioral and emotional problems and to remain poor. And the number of those kids is growing every year from 11% of American children in 1960 to current estimates of 40%. In low-income neighbors, those percentages are even higher. So where are the dads and what are they doing about parenting? Joining us now is Timothy Nelson. He lectures on social policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and he is co-author with his wife, Catherine Eden, of a new book titled Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
You co-wrote this book with your wife. She usually writes about women's issues. How did you decide there was another side worth exploring in this scenario?
Yes, you're right. She's written several books about low-income single moms, and people kept asking her when she would go around and give talks about that. Well, what about the men? What's their story? And she at first resisted that, thinking that she knew everything she needed to from talking to the moms. But eventually, she decided she better take a look at that and recruited me to come on board to do some of the interviews and eventually co-write the book. So, and she was quite actually surprised by going out there and hearing the men's side of things.
You moved your family to be closer to the low-income communities you cover in the book. Where did you live, and how did that help your research?
Well, we moved into East Camden, New Jersey, just one of the neighborhoods one of the poorest cities in America, and it was very eye-opening. I think having the experience of living, in the same neighborhoods as the men we were talking to was. It just gave us some experience to draw on to formulate some questions and get inside, some of the realities that they have to live with all of the time. So it was a very valuable experience. And we had two, my daughters were both quite young at the time, preschool age. And, so I was looking at things from a parent's perspective as well.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Timothy Nelson. He's co-author of Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. If you consider yourself a father in the inner city, someone who is apart from their children and want to give us a call and tell us your story, we welcome it. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your comment. Or if you have a question, of course, post your question there as well. You found that for young men growing up in the inner city, nothing motivates them more than becoming a father. So tell me what we mean by motivating them as opposed to what?
Well, it's, so just to be clear about who we're talking about here, the men that we spoke with were all low income, they were both African-American and white fathers in roughly equal numbers, not just young fathers. We also, okay. Half of the people we talked to were over the age of 30 and half were under. So we tried to get full, yeah.
It's perspective then.
Yeah. In terms of what we found is the intense meaning that children have for these men. Because when you talk to guys at the bottom of the labor market and so on, they're not getting sort of their meaning from work or from, other sorts of things that maybe middle-class men do. And oftentimes they see children actually as a way and as giving them some purpose to get themselves together, to maybe deal with a substance abuse issue or work on a relationship or do what they need to do in order to stay connected to their kids.
It was surprising how easily they talked to you and as much information. It was surprising how much information they would give and also how much it appeared that they had thought about. It wasn't a thoughtless role. They felt strongly about it.
Yeah, in terms of it was just a great experience. We tried to sit down with the guys on a couple different occasions, often for two or 3 hours over several days and get their whole life story and everything. And what's really remarkable is that often, we often have images of men in these neighborhoods, especially young men, just hanging around with their friends and, having a very intense peer culture. then that rarely happens outside of adolescence. These guys have so much to say and so much is going on, and you know, someone like me coming in and telling and asking them these questions that they, as you said, thought very deeply about, you know, it was a cathartic experience for them, and they told me just incredible things. I feel, you know, very privileged to have been in these kinds of conversations with them.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So they're very excited when they find out the baby's on the way, and they're excited when the baby arrives. Why is it then that despite all of this purpose and enthusiasm, they still appear to fail at the role?
That's a great question, and it is it's a complicated sort of story here. So, but part of it is that they're more excited about the baby than they are about the relationship in which the baby is introduced into, and so that leads. And I should say that these pregnancies happen very early in the relationship. The average being about 6 months from the time of meeting the child's mother to the time of a pregnancy. And then it's all about sort of trying to build a relationship at that point, maybe moving in together and really sort of starting to get things together for the sake of the baby. And then when the baby arrives, they often realize they don't really know each other that well. And anyone who's you know, been a parent of a newborn can tell you it's a very stressful thing. You know, and at the same time, you're dealing with, you know, deep financial issues. And also, in these communities, it's kind of the opposite of the old shotgun marriage. In the old days, you know, there were pressures for couples to get married in the face of an unexpected pregnancy. These days, in these communities, there's often a countervailing pressure. His mother and kin maybe think that she's trying to trick him, and that's not really his child. Her mother and kin are sort of saying, why are you with this guy? He's no good. And so they're just dealing with a lot of stress.
So the city's filled with fatherless children. Most of them include boys who will become absentee fathers if the trend continues. What in their lives suggests that parenthood is a good option when they're teenagers, under employed or unemployed and not in a relationship with the mother? What's their paradigm here?
Well, I should say, first of all, when you ask them, as we did, sort of what their values are, in other words, what's the right way to go about having a kid? What's the ideal situation? They'll tell you, oh, you should stay in school, you should go to college, you should get married, and you should have kids then when you're financially able to take care of them. And they'll say, look at me, I didn't do any of that. But that's the right way to do things. Things didn't turn out for me that way. So it's not a question of values. It's a question of, are you really able to activate those values growing up in these kinds of neighborhoods with these resources, with the lack of employment, and so on. So in the face of, you know, not much else in your life, the possibility of a child takes on a huge symbolic significance. It's something pure and, you know, pure potential that you can put all of your energy into.
All right, so you do it once, and then you find out how hard it is.
Yeah, and then,
as some people, for those among us who wonder, then why in the world do they keep having more babies? You raise the issue of selective fathering in the inner city, and I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, because if you look at the statistics, you know, despite how happy they are about the pregnancy and their good, you know, their intentions to make things work, there's a lot of optimism. These guys are at the hospital watching their children being born. Other studies have shown among this same population that if you interview couples in the hospital of unmarried children, there's a good high percentage that say that they plan on getting married, et cetera. But then it all falls apart. By the time the child reaches the age of five, you know, almost all of these relationships have broken up. And due to some of the things that I talked about before, and these breakups are often very bitter. And this is the point at which She may start keeping him out of the picture. He may be locked up for a while. You know, there's things that intervene that all of a sudden separate him from these children, but the desire to father is still there, and that's why a new relationship happens, a new pregnancy that may come quicker than you know is ideal, and they, you know, if they are shut out from parenting their older children, they'll try again in a new relationship, and so that's what contributes to some of this dynamic.
It appears that nobody's really worried about contraceptives, that prophylactics are used for STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, but once they have a relationship going and they feel comfortable that the other, you know, that their partner isn't having sex with anybody else, that goes away. And so there's really not a fear of getting pregnant.
Yeah, that's right. So, condoms and so on are as you said, are used in the beginning of the relationship. And that's important because some people may think that, you know, education about birth control and so on is the problem. But these guys know that. They know how to do that. But the, you know, stopping condom use and so on is, as you say, a signal of trust in the relationship. And, excuse me. But it's interesting. They often don't have the conversation with their partner explicitly about, oh, I guess we're really trying to have a baby now.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of a don't ask, don't tell approach to birth control. And each of them kind of secretly or subconsciously is favorable, at least more favorable than not, to having a child, often for their own reasons. And even though guys know that they're not in the best circumstances to be bringing a child into the world, it's still, you know, something that they're, you know, still quite, you know, quite happy about.
My guest is Timothy Nelson. He is the co-author of Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. It's the result of it's a book he's written with his wife about 100 low-income, equally divided between black and white men in East Camden, New Jersey, one of the poorest places in the country. If you have a question or comment for Timothy, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Wexner Heritage Village, home of geriatric planning solutions. Now there's a GPS for families navigating the complex and changing landscape of senior health care. More on Wexner Heritage Village's geriatric planning solutions at whv.org.
Teens read a lot of books written at a fifth grade level.
By the time they hit late middle school, we don't see a lot of increase in the difficulty of books children are choosing to read.
Many high school teachers assign easy books, too.
The average was around the sixth grade level.
The dumbing down of high school reading, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on 89.7 NPR News. The WOSU Member Card Benefit of the Month for June is the Wexner Center for the Arts. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission to the galleries all month long. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Deadbeat dads, it's a catchy phrase, but is it accurate or just a stereotype that has enabled the rest of us to look down on who we perceive them to be, or worse, to ignore their plight? Still with us is Timothy J. Nelson. He's co-author of a new book titled Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. And once again, Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I was interested in the idea of their definition of doing the best they can. I asked earlier, why does it appear that they fail at that role? And not my version of what failure might be or someone else's isn't necessarily what theirs is.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things we found is that, you know, the idea that men should be breadwinners, that fathers should, you know, be the primary financial support of children has really become diminished in these neighborhoods and among these fathers. And the idea of doing the best I can often came up, particularly when we asked about what they were doing financially to support their kids. And again, these are low-income fathers, so they do have limited financial resources. And oftentimes, they were, you know, so challenged that it was pretty much a struggle for them just to make ends meet for themselves, just to make enough money for them to get by. Almost none of these guys had places of their own. In fact, I don't think anyone I interviewed had a lease in their own name. They were, you know, in sleeping at friends' houses or on their sister's couch or all over the place. what money they did have after they sort of met their own needs, you know, they tried to distribute to their kids. But it was nowhere near half of what it cost to raise a child. And I think this is where a lot of the conflict with the children's moms comes in, because, you know, he's really, you know, not contributing what she feels that he should. So they've redefined fatherhood away from the financial, and they've really embraced what used to be a more middle-class idea of fathers as being more on the emotional end of things, the caring and nurturing and being your child's best friend and so on, because this is the kind of fatherhood that they feel most able to accomplish.
Do they follow through on that? Are they, we call them absentee fathers, but are they there for their children?
They're there to the extent that they can be. And as I said, there's a lot of challenges mm-hmm. with them staying connected with their kids. Some of it because they don't have a stable place to live, they can't really do, you know, the kind of visitation that maybe divorced middle-class dads have, because there's no place to, you know, to bring the child. Mm-hmm. And there's often gatekeeping issues with the child's mother. Again, after the relationship ends, she's probably going to find another relationship fairly quickly, and then it becomes there's a lot of sexual mistrust. There's lots of issues in these repartnering kinds of situations. And again, these guys are, you know, they maybe have spells of incarceration afterwards, which take them out of the picture. There's just all these things that can intervene with them staying connected with their kids.
Paul in Columbus, you're on the air with Tim Nelson. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, I just wanted to pretty much, I mean, I kind of agree with what he's saying, but at the same time, some of the biggest issues I run into is from the mother herself. I have a son in Indiana, and I'm, again, like you said, from Columbus, Ohio, and any time I want to see him, I have to drive 5.5 hours out there to pick him up, 5.5 hours back, and then there I'm back again for the weekend when I take him back. And, you know, she makes no attempt to help me, you know, meet me halfway or, you know, give me a little bit of gas money or anything else like that. You know, I have my own place. I've always had my own place. So, it's, you know, not like something I don't have somewhere to take him. It's always been a struggle with me to get to her to find... You know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good point, and we kind of were skirting around it, but I'm not sure, Tim Nelson, whether this is something you dealt with, but what are the mother's expectations? Do they share any kind of hope or have any kind of hope that the father will be involved, and do they take responsibility for making that happen?
You know, that's a great question. Some guys would say that the mothers of their kids were really great and would really try to facilitate their involvement in their kids' lives. And then, you know, so at the other end of the spectrum, there was a lot of complaint about, you know, she treats the child as her own. And for unmarried parents, which are the people in the book here, it's legally, that's basically true. You know, the father has no actual rights. Often, as I said, these guys are in the hospital with when their kids being born. They will sign paternity statements. The only thing that really gets them is a child support award. It does not buy them anything legally. And you know, fathers with more resources, as the gentleman's saying, you know, even with your own place, even with somewhat of a cooperation with the child's mother, it's still really difficult. And for these guys, you know, the mom can pretty much move and not tell him where she is, and he has no recourse. So it's a very difficult situation.
Yeah, hang in there, Paul. Thanks a lot for that call. If anybody else wants to give us a call and share their story, give us you can go to 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You say that there are three interlocking factors at work to erode the father-child connection over time. Can you talk about those?
Sometimes it's a matter of him not quite getting his life together the mm-hmm. way that he needs to. And part of this is because he underinvests in the romantic relationship with the child's mother. He's more focused on the child than the child's mother, thinking, oh, if we break up, that's all right. I'll still have access to my child and so on. And I think he tends to overestimate, how that will play out in the face of a breakup. So oftentimes, you know, there's mom's gatekeeping, there's bitterness in relationships and so on. But there's also the fact that maybe he doesn't quite stop the sort of ripping and running that he needs to, in terms of substance abuse, in terms of other kinds of issues, which will not only erode the relationship with the child's mother, but might send him back to jail and so on. And that's a very big problem in these communities about time incarcerated is time away from their own children, especially when the kids are quite young and they don't really have that chance to bond. Employment issues. You know, you really need stable financial resources to be a good parent. And as long as you're scrambling and just to make ends meet from day to day or week to week, you just don't really have any leftover psychic energy to invest in those relationships. So, there's a lot coming at these guys.
Yeah, I mean, they're in that. A lot of them are in the cycle of trying to find a job, can't find a job, do something wrong, get busted,
being incarcerated,
get out of jail, mm-hmm. felon on your record, blah, blah, blah.
Right. So it's just it's an incredible sort of cycle of disadvantage that follows them. As I said, the one thing that kind of keeps them hopeful and keeps them trying, and a lot of guys do eventually make it. There's a guy in Camden named Joe who was sent to prison, had big substance abuse problems, but eventually finally got his life together, got married, had additional kids, and now, you know, kind of is a testimony to the fact that almost all these guys will eventually, stay alive,
right,
will make it. The statistics show that, you know, people eventually marry. May not be to the mothers of their kids, but eventually people slow down, people's lives become more stable, and they eventually achieve those things.
To what extent is the idealization of marriage part of the issue? In these neighborhoods, the norm is single-parent households with the mother at the head, so there are no role models even for marriage, let alone fatherhood. Yet, you say, in the end, if they survive, and there's not a great survival rate, but if they survive, they will end up getting married. They idealize marriage.
Yeah, and that's another, I think, thing that we think, because marriage tends to be rare, especially when in the younger years, that it must not be on their horizon at all. So when we ask guys about marriage, it's something that they definitely aspire to, but not until they have things together. And this is true increasingly in the working class as well as some of the more disadvantaged people we spoke with. But there's an idea that your finances have to be in order. You know, you have to build a lot of trust in relationship, and trust is a huge issue. among the men we spoke to. And so when we ask sort of when do you see marriage happening for you, guys will often say, well, maybe the late 30s or early 40s is when I'm going to get myself together. And because of some of the the lifestyles in these neighborhoods, they're really not entering into the labor force until maybe their mid-20s. Mm-hmm. Often very disadvantaged, maybe not having a high school diploma and so on. So it's taking them a long time to really get themselves situated.
It's interesting that the idealized marriage, because many of us, you know, those of us who still grew up at least part of our childhood with both parents in the house, we know that they argue and disagree and maybe don't live that idealized life, but they survive in the marriage. We see them surviving. That's how we figure out how to do it ourselves, those of us who go on and get married and mm-hmm. survive a marriage. What are they looking at for role models? How are they figuring out how to do it?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, particularly for the African Americans that we talked to, there was less marriage in their own background,
okay.
Among extended family and so on. And so they, you know, but they often maybe had, people in a church that they were raised in, maybe their grandparents who were mm-hmm. often from the South, or a school principal or somebody in their life who they could, you know, however distant that they could see. Whites tended to have more role models close at hand, higher percentage their own parents were married or aunts and uncles and things of that sort.
So what other kind of to what extent do we see correlations between the races, are there any other breakouts?
Racial differences?
Yeah.
The primary story here is a social class story, not mm-hmm. a race story. There are a few differences around the margins in terms of race, but because the whites we spoke to were from Kensington and Fishtown in Philadelphia, which are pretty disadvantaged neighborhoods and fairly unique. Most poor whites do not live in neighborhoods with high poverty rates. They're more interspersed throughout the population. Mm-hmm. So this was a way to see, you know, what was sort of race, what's neighborhood, what's poverty, and so on. And if you look at whites in this situation, they look a lot like African Americans, which suggests that this is really a story of social class and concentrated poverty.
You tentatively titled the book I read, you tentatively titled it Marginal Men, Fatherhood and the Lies of Low-Income Unmarried Men. Were you referring to them as marginal to the child's life or marginal to society or something different?
Yeah, both actually, and that's the idea of marginality, I think, is so strong here because they are marginal. I mean, they're marginal to the economy. They've always felt marginal in the educational system, and when their kids' moms start pushing them out of their children's lives, saying, "I don't really need you," right, and you know, sort of being edged out of the one relationship that they really want to invest in. This is what makes them so angry, because they realize that, you know, who needs them? Nobody needs them in society. And they really, you know, they are sort of disposable in a way that, I think contributes a lot to the substance abuse and the psychological issues and a lot of the problems that we see.
What surprised you about your research? Did anything really jump out, or have we already talked about it perhaps?
Well, I think the initial thing was how excited these guys were to be fathers. That
yeah.
that really blew us away.
Yeah.
We tell the story of a young high school boy finding out that he's going to become a father with a girl he'd already broken up with, and he was so excited he was jumping around his room saying, "Thank you, Jesus." Although around his own mother and aunt, he played like he was very upset because he realized that they were very disapproving of this. But he was so determined not to be like his own father, who had really abandoned the family, and was really, you know, it was a chance for him to do something positive, he felt, in the face of all the negativity of his neighborhood with the gangs and the drugs and the violence and all that. He did not see himself as in a deviant sort of way at all. So that was one of the most surprising things.
I wonder what books they're reading, what magazines they're reading, what television shows they're watching, what movies they're watching that suggest to them in any way that they've got a chance to make a go of this.
Well, that's interesting.
Who on their block is doing it? Where are they seeing this this pattern play out successfully?
You know, there's a lot of hope despite the negativity. And these guys, I should say, are quite. When you speak to them about some of the failures of parenting, especially some of their older children that they had when they were quite young, there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of guilt over that. But there is also a lot of optimism that this time I can get it together. I'm in a more stable position now, and so on. And a lot of these guys do, like Joe that I mentioned earlier, who is able, after some pretty rough experiences, to pull it together. But, you know, all of us are optimistic. You know, if we knew before we got into this what our kids would be like as teenagers, we probably wouldn't do it.
Oh, how true that is. I guess I'm just trying to figure out that's what keeps us alive, really. I mean, it's so we take it for granted, but having something to hope for is kind of necessary to the human condition.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the city of Camden, inscribed on the city hall in Camden, are the words, "Without a vision, the people perish," which ultimately goes back to the Bible, but also Walt Whitman, who Camden claims as one of their own, used that phrase. And it's just so poignant to see that sort of overlooking the landscape of desolation, that as we from outside think, how can anyone have hope in these neighborhoods? But once you get in there and you really, you know, understand how people live, and the kinds of challenges, but also the joys of things like fatherhood and so on. It gives you a much fuller picture.
So you're talking to one generation of men. What do we know about their children? How are they faring?
That's a great question. There's some more quantitative work which looks at these at unmarried fathers. And it really asks the question from the father's point of view rather than child's. To what extent are these unmarried fathers parenting any of their children intensively? And by intensively, that means being in contact with them once a week or more. The answer is that over 80% of these guys have contact with at least one of their children. Now, because of the fact that they're having multiple children with multiple partners, this often means that some of their children they have no contact with. And that's the devastating thing. And that is, one of the real problems that needs to be addressed. But for looking at it from the father's perspective, it speaks to this idea that these guys really do want to parent. And if we could help them stay connected to their older kids, I think we would undercut a lot of this, you know, this dynamic of then having child in a new relationship because they really do want that experience of being a father.
I'm talking with Timothy Nelson. He's co-author of a new book. It's called Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. If you have a story you want to tell, you want to join the conversation, questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Coming up, Stephanie Hightower. She's president and CEO of the Columbus Urban League. We're going to talk about a program there to work on some of these issues. So we'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
We got 12 bottles of water, 56 beers, 2 vodkas, 4 whiskey, 6 bottles of wine, tequila, Nutella, cheese, steaks, a Milky Way.
That's Seth Rogen in This Is the End, a parody of end of the world movies. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who co-wrote and co-directed the film and co-wrote Superbad. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Homeport Noble on Long Condominiums, offering home ownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring a diverse community with a mix of historic and newly built homes and condos. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long.
Wednesday night, join WOSU-TV for a look at how your genetic makeup could hold the key to the future of medicine. Joe Palca of NPR's Science Friday moderates a panel of doctors, geneticists, ethicists, and journalists as they examine a rapidly expanding field of medicine that could transform healthcare. Watch Genomics and the Potential for Personal Treatment Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV. 89.7 NPR News is your all-day NPR news station, bringing you news and information 7 days a week and always streaming at WOSU.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you don't grow up with a dad, how do you know how to be a dad? Still with us to talk about that, especially as it pertains to the risk factors of inner city life, is Timothy J. Nelson. He's co-author of a new book titled Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. And joining us now for a look at a local program is Stephanie Hightower. She's president and CEO of the Columbus Urban League. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Thank you, Ann.
So as part of the Columbus Urban League's African American Male Initiative, which started back in 2007, there is the Father to Father program, recognizing a lot of what we've been talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is what we think a very relevant needed program in the urban core. And we're just really proud that our funders, recognize the relevancy of this program and continue to fund it, because it's much needed as we need to stabilize the urban community and stabilize families. This is a primary component.
Tim was saying that some make it, the ones who survive, being their youth, plug away and keep plugging away at it, and eventually they get married and do have a relationship with at least some of their children. What do you know about the ones that make it in a program like Father to Father?
Well, you know what? Here's, it's so complex, and I think as Mr. Nelson pointed out in his books, the complexities of the environments in which most of these men come from really exacerbate their ability to become stabilized and to eventually become successful dads. Case in point, we know that a lot of ex-offenders, as you know, have children. When you look at the Columbus City schools, there is over a 95% of those children who have fathers or mothers that have been incarcerated at one point in time. And so a lot of these men come out of the penal system. They don't have jobs. They cannot pay their child support. All right. They have now a felony conviction, labeled behind their names. And so it doesn't give them the ability to then be able to be good dads. Part of being a good dad, we hear over and over again, is to be able to provide for your children and your families. And a lot of times the mothers, if they cannot provide, meaning pay that child support, then they do not allow them to see their kids. So with our program, one of the things we work very diligently on is, number one, we try to find them employment through our workforce development program. There's a wraparound approach. We work very closely with child support enforcement. So if we can come up with a way to mediate between the father and the mother to be able to reduce those child support payments down, or, wipe them out completely, that begins to start that healing process between the parents so that they can see their children.
Tim Nelson and I were talking earlier about the definition of providing for and being a provider. It's different. It's not necessarily half of everything I have or half of everything, just as much as the mother gives financially. It's what I have left over. After.
Well, absolutely. But again, the complexities of that really make it hard for especially unemployed fathers. I'll give you a case in point. So when I first started working at the Columbus Urban League, this story just tore my heart apart. And I understood now the importance of why we had to do our work. We had a gentleman who we finally found employment. And as soon as he had finished his first 2 weeks of work, he had a new family on top of having to pay child support. And so as soon as he got that first check and went to his employer, got his check, and he had $5 in the check. So child support enforcement hadn't worked the way it needed to and completely wiped his check clean. He came over and said, guys, I really need your help, need you to work with me with child support enforcement, and let's get this rectified. 2 weeks later, same deal. This guy comes back in tears. He said, I can't go home. I cannot provide for my family. So we have this process where, now I have to say, our work with child support enforcement has gotten better. Very, very well. I mean, Susan Brown over there and her folks, they really work with us to help to mediate these kinds of issues. But what that does is it puts them in a situation where they can't even provide the basis. I can't buy my child some food. I can't take him to McDonald's. I can't even, do anything. So.
But the difference here is that they have father to father to go to now. They have a resource they feel like they can at least go to and say, how do I get started in fixing this problem? Tim Nelson, what about the larger policies at play here? Are there programs like father to father replicated across the country in different, variations on the theme?
You know, there's not nearly enough.
Absolutely.
This is a great program, and there are other programs out there. I was aware of one in Charleston, South Carolina, where basically a lawyer was volunteering her time and had weekly groups with men trying to figure out the child support system and how, she could advocate for them and so on. Child support is complex because on the one hand, the kids need resources, right? But the men are often so unstably employed, just because the jobs, aren't there. They may be in work 1 week and out the next. Mm-hmm. They are shifting around, and child support awards are just so inflexible, mm-hmm. and you really need someone to advocate for you in that situation. It's just such a difficult situation.
Stephanie, to what extent do you work with the fathers on just how teaching them or helping them understand how to be with their kids?
Absolutely.
And what that is?
Well, there's a lot of behavioral modification that has to go on throughout this program. And it is, great parenting skills. So one of the things that we do as a part, again, of the program is we have to provide opportunities to help teach men how to be dads. So you may not think that for us, those of us who maybe grew up in two-parent homes or had a stable parent that had resources available, but we provide opportunities for them to be good dads and parent. And so about a month ago, we had an event out at Franklin Park called Fishing with Dads. And it was a Saturday morning. It was a gloomy day.
Central Ohio.
Exactly, these days. But it gave dads an opportunity to bring their kids. We gave out free fishing poles, not nearly enough. We only had 100. We ended up with over 350 men showed up with their children that morning. Now, a lot of it was, the mothers dropping the kids off, dumping them off and running for cover because they had, in the morning and afternoon. But you also have to provide those kinds of opportunities and exposure for men to be able to be good dads. And so, again, that's a part of our program, is creating those opportunities. It's one thing to be in a classroom learning and hearing other people talk at you, but it's another thing for you to then have to go out and actually apply those parenting skills in a setting where you have other dads, other role models, other people to be, that you can, now have a role model to actually emulate. And that's what we try to do.
Tim Nelson, what did you learn about from the guys you interviewed about what they did with their children?
Well, it's interesting. They try to do a lot of the, you know, sort of the things around Philadelphia that, you know, every parent wants to do with their child, the Please Touch Museum, go to Penn's Landing. For some of the younger kids, just take them to the park and so on. And guys emphasize that you really do need to have, you know, some walking around money to spend on your kids. You got to be able to, you know, in Philly, a big thing is water ice. You got to be able to go do that, take your kid to McDonald's and so on. It's just spending what and the idea of quality time comes up over and over and over again, and doing educational things as well. This is what the guys really want to do with their kids.
Do they feel a sense of involvement in their children's school and that sort of thing? Or is that something that's lacking and could be addressed?
Yeah, it's because they, you know, are not really in the same household with the kids. And really when they do see the kids, they really want it to be a fun sort of time. Maybe a sort of poor man's version of a Disneyland dad would be the negative way to look at this, but they really see themselves as investing in the relationships, and they know how precarious their situation is, and so they really they try to stay more on the fun activity sides of things.
You know, my dad traveled a lot when I was growing up, really 48 weeks a year, and he rarely ever saw me perform in the band or sit on the bench during volleyball. but it would have meant a lot to me for him to see that. Is that something, Stephanie Hightower, that they talk about? That you don't always have to be entertaining them. You can just be there for them. Is that important?
Absolutely. Those participatory activities. So, you know, to your point about schools, maybe you might not be engaged in, as Tim pointed out, the day-to-day oversight of making sure that your kids do your homework. But we're trying to create those kinds of after-school programming that gives those fathers an opportunity to be, do that. So maybe twice a week you come to the after-school program at the Columbus Urban League, and it's a read with dads. Now, on the other hand, we also have dads that still don't have their GEDs and may not be able to read. Mm-hmm. So it's those kinds. You have to have a variety of different kinds of activities like that to be able to engage those dads with those kids. But we do say, you know, can you go to your kid's soccer game? Again, they may not have those, as you know, in urban school settings. So we're looking at how do we create those kinds of opportunities. So we create our own soccer league. We create our own basketball league. So, again, the dads can also participate with their kids, but they can also be there to actually watch their kids and engage with their kids that way.
See, Tim Nelson, did any of these guys have grow up with a dad and don't and are really struggling because they aren't able to do what their own dad did?
Yeah, some. I mean, again, there's a variety across the population. Some of them had those who did come from two-parent households. Sometimes, you know, their dad was there, but he was just a paycheck. He would come home and not really interact with the kids. You know, they really felt the lack of that. And so to them, that's not real fatherhood. Fatherhood is being engaged in a relationship with your child, even if you do, if you are a good financial provider.
And Stephanie, as far as father-to-father goes, are there efforts to reunite fathers with older children that maybe they've been separated from for a long time? Is that something they work on?
Again, what you'll find, we have, you know, the gamut. We have 17-year-olds that could be new fathers or high school, you know, teen parents, all the way up to those individuals who are, you know, in their mid-40s and early 50s that also have been a part of that program. So absolutely, there's still that whole notion of being a father that is important to those individuals, and that's why they come to our program.
Yeah, we were talking about that sense of hope and how important that is.
Absolutely. You know, when you finally get, you know, an opportunity for someone to really look at stabilizing their lives, and especially what I've found with those individuals who are in our Choose to Change, which is our ex-offender population, those individuals in particular, if they've been incarcerated for long periods of time, they don't have those relationships with their kids, and they've gotten to that point where they're choosing to change, and one of those components of that is reuniting with their children. And they do have that sense of hope, and they know that it's probably going to be hard, but they're willing to take that chance and take that risk. And sometimes that can be very painful.
Is there work to be done with the mothers and helping them help the fathers, you know, establish these relationships and helping them value them as well? Because it sounds like at least some of these guys that Tim Nelson talked to, they don't, the mothers don't value them.
You know what? It's so funny that you said that. We just submitted a proposal to the state under the Fatherhood Commission. Those RFPs were due last week, as a matter of fact. And one of the things that the state was very smart to add into the RFP was the fact that if you're going to continue to run these kinds of programs, you have to have a motherhood parenting component attached to it. Because you're absolutely right. We can look at changing the father's behavior, but we have a responsibility for those mothers to also look at them and their behavior, because you'll find a lot of time the resistance is from if the mother and father are no longer engaged in a healthy and productive relationship, they will stop the fathers from seeing their children. And so there is a component now, you know, we're hopeful that we will get refunded from the state, and there will be a huge component on their own motherhood attached to our program.
Tim Nelson agreed that that's a factor in all of this as well.
Oh yeah, and that sounds like a great thing. And the more I hear about your program, the more I wish there were one in every city around the country, because it sounds like you're doing phenomenal work.
Well, Timothy Nelson, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Timothy Nelson is co-author with his wife, Catherine Eden, of a new book. It's titled Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. And Stephanie Hightower, thank you as well for joining us today.
Thank you.
Any upcoming events? I think graduation you mentioned.
Well, you know what? We're in the middle of a cohort right now.
Okay.
And so we'll be having graduation around August the 27th. Okay. I just invited love for you to come. And then we will have a new cohort for Father to Father that will begin in September. And so we are accepting applications now. And, you know, always looking for, and, you know, those funders who understand the relevancy of those programs, because sometimes those, you know, funding dollars only limit us to be able to do certain things. I was just telling my crew, you know, I want to do a trip to Zambezi Bay this summer with dads and fathers, mm-hmm. and we get them out there with their kids. Those are the kinds of wonderful memories that you want to be able to help fathers and children make together through our kinds of programs.
We'll post the link to Father on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll